Hey guys, welcome back to our Morningstar Men's podcast. This morning we begin a new series. It's entitled, What Would Jesus Say? And the concept behind the series is, what would it be like if we could, just like first century believers, come up and talk with Jesus personally? I think we all have ideas that we fancy about how we would have discussions with Jesus and some of the challenging questions we'd ask him. And the bigger question behind the questions is, do we really want to know God's heart, or do we want to try to change God's heart? And as you'll hear me pose somewhere in the middle of the morning's presentation, it's like, I think sometimes we ask questions of other people, not because we really want to know their reasons, but we ask questions more to imply that somehow if we were to make their decisions, we'd make them differently. And so we'll explore that this morning. And we're going to continue then in this new series, rotate 1 week in the Manly Men, and then the next week in this What Would Jesus Say? I think you're going to find this very challenging, very helpful. This morning's material, I think, will cause you to think in some new ways, maybe about your own followership with Jesus. So, hope you're blessed. As always, please consider sharing this material with somebody that you believe this week could be helped by it. Thanks, guys. Have a great week. Catch up with you again next week. Did it? Had no idea. All right, so by now I hope the handouts have made their way around. We're starting a new series. And like the previous series, we're going to mix this up. We're going to go back to the Manly Men book next week. So, the new series, What Would Jesus Say? And I was watching a movie the other week, and a single line in the movie prompted the topic. I wish I could tell you the name of the movie. I don't even really remember a whole lot about it. I just remember that there was this guy and something bad happened to his family and he was really brewing over the difficulties that had come to him. And he had a good job before. He was pretty prominent in whatever he did. But a spirit of, we'll call it vigilantism, sort of took hold in his life. And since the law was not addressing whatever this difficulty was that had befallen his family, since the law wasn't doing anything about it, he would. And over a period of time, those closest to him at work, some other family members and friends, they definitely noticed a difference. And not only did they notice a difference, but when they read the newspaper, they could sort of sense that perhaps he knew more about what was happening in the news than he was letting on. And so one day, and I think he may have been in some sort of publication business, one day what I believe was his editor came into the room and said to him, maybe you should take some time off. I think this thing has really gotten the best of you. You just seem angry all the time. And he said back to the editor, he said, my anger is all I have left. Would you want to take that away from me too? Now, it's superficial perhaps, and at face value in a movie, it might seem kind of cheesy, but the reality is we know a lot of people who live like that. And maybe it's not their anger, maybe it's something else. And honestly, I probably don't remember a lot about the next 15 minutes of the movie because I was just stuck on that line. And I thought to myself, because this is the nature of what I do and all that, what would I have to say to that guy? More importantly, what would Jesus have to say to that guy? Because you know that Jesus was approachable and people came to Jesus and they asked Jesus questions all the time. What is it that God would have to say to us if we could stand next to him? And I'm sure some, has anybody ever wanted to ask God a question? Huh? Or more importantly, and it's somewhere in the notes, but more importantly, have you ever wanted to ask God a question that sounded like a question, but really it wasn't a question at all? It was really more a statement about how you felt that God should have done things differently. So when you ask, why God, why is it like this? You really didn't want an answer to why it was like that, truthfully. What did you want? You wanted God to know that you were really genuinely upset about it being the way it was, and you really thought that God did a bad job of handling it. Can we say that at least one or two of us in the room have experienced that already? Yeah. And so I thought it might be instructive in the coming weeks to just bore down into the Scriptures and explore some things that Jesus might have said to particular circumstances. Now, we're going to look in broad terms today, but I want you to just put that on ice for a minute, that basic idea, and we're going to come visit another idea. And the idea is, what is school? Because about a month and a half ago, much to Scott's regret and against his better advice, I decided that I would rename our little thing that we do here, whatever that is here on Saturday mornings, that I would call it Life School. And you know the acronym LIFE that we use a lot? Anybody know what it stands for? Anybody even remember? LIFE? Every day. Okay, so what would life school then be?
Teaching us how to live in freedom every day.
Exactly. It would be helping us to live in freedom every day, because just because you have been granted freedom doesn't mean that you know how to live in freedom. Have you ever been free of something and gotten yourself enslaved again? Just think credit cards. If nothing else comes to mind, just think credit cards. See, we don't always know how to live in freedom. And so I thought it would be very helpful to have life school. But when you think of school, and this is why Scott said, no, that's a bad name. That is a really bad name. And so I had to sneak this behind Scott. Being the men's ministry leader that he is, I felt bad about challenging his authority directly, so I just went ahead and did what I wanted to behind his back. What do you think school? When you think school, what do you think?
Detention.
What'd you say?
Detention.
Detention.
The parental
having what?
Having to listen.
Okay, see, now you're all confirming everything that Scott thought, which is why we shouldn't brand it Life School. Does anything else come to mind?
Learning.
Well, let's the positives are being outweighed by the negatives here, at least 2-1. And all the time, Scott is just eating.
Equipping,
yes.
Wisdom.
There you go. There you go. He's a one man rebuttal agency.
I'm trying to help you. Well, one lady here likes to call me the principal to learn a little more. And I said, please don't do that. It's gonna scare her. She never wanna come back to church again.
Well, when the Greeks used the word school, and they actually did, it was in a really favorable context. So, imagine yourself having to work, which shouldn't be hard. Imagine yourself having to work a lot and work hard. And so, in the Greek mindset, school was a place where you could come and get refreshed and relaxed, and you could use some of your leisure time to be better equipped for your working time. So that in the process of setting aside time to refresh the body, you were nurturing the mind and better able to go back out and be able to respond well to the challenges, to the circumstances of your life. So that's what we're going to do. That's what we're going to do today. So I want to start by asking this. If you're going to show up at Life School every week, what should be going through your mind as you walk in the door? Now, okay, let me help you out here. The correct answer is not, I wonder if there's two Boston cream donuts this week and not just one. Well, what would be going through your mind? What am I going to be challenged with? But here's something more. How many of you use the term physical fitness ever? In a sentence, usually followed by or preceded by I am not or something like that. How many of you use this phrase spiritual fitness? How many of you would, on a scale of 1 to 10, judge your spiritual fitness? What does that even mean? What would it look like to be spiritually fit? And in the Greek mind, school was a place where there was interaction, where the participants not only listened to a lecture, but they also interacted with the lecturer and with each other so as to cement the understandings into their own mind. This is a time for audience participation. What would spiritual fitness look like to you?
For me, it's the ability to come and submit to somebody else's authority so I can learn, and then to be able to take that authority and use it in the community.
Okay, so this time right here is a time when you would come to receive, come to participate, come to gain something. How do you know when you're spiritually fit? This is a very important question. So, just so that everybody gets this, how do you know when you're physically fit? Is that really it? Is that it? You know you're physically fit because you can't even flex your arms anymore because there's so much muscle mass in the way? How do you know when you're not physically fit? Let's try it that way.
When you're gasping for air.
There you go. When you're when the flight of stairs seems like something that you'd rather just take the elevator, right? Then you know you're not physically fit. You're not able to meet. Come on, let's express this in real terms. I want you to remember this. Because it's going to matter to you this week, I promise. How do I know when I am not physically fit? Well, that's spiritually. I know that I am not physically fit when my body is not able to meet the demands that are placed upon it, at least in everyday living. Have you encountered a situation, let's say in the past month, that revealed to you an area where your body was weak? And it's not a joke. I mean, we can laugh at it, but yes, absolutely. Well, let's just take that right over into the spiritual context. Have you been exposed to areas in your spiritual life? What's your spiritual life? I've hammered this home so many times, somebody needs to get this immediately. What's your spiritual life? It's how your inner man responds to everything in his outer world. It's how I relate to myself, it's how I relate to God, it's how I relate to every other human being, and it's how I relate to the created order. That is my spiritual life. Come on, you're writing notes like you haven't heard that before.
That's a good thing.
So, with that as a definition, an operating definition, then, how do I know when I'm spiritually fit? When I'm responding in ways that honor God, when I'm responding in ways that bless others, when I'm responding in ways that don't unnecessarily take advantage of the created world. When I'm responding in good and helpful ways and not in bad ways. Now we're going to look at two distinct responses, two types of spiritual response in just a couple of minutes. But now let's think about it. Has life revealed to you in the past week an area where you are not as spiritually fit as you would like to be? You don't need to say any more because I have a feeling that you're not the only one that has been tested in that realm. That's all I have to say on that right now. Okay, so we know. Now, what do you do with that? What do you and I do with those times when we feel, oh my word, I've just discovered that I'm not spiritually fit? Do you ignore it? Do you just say, well, I guess I'm going to get better the next time? But what do you do when you find out that you're winded after running up a flight of stairs? What do you do about that? Do you take the elevator the next time? Or do you develop a plan for being better prepared the next time. So, and this is the big question. Why do we come here? Do we come here just to because it's part of a routine? Or are you genuinely aware of areas where you are not as spiritually fit as you would like to be, and you are coming here with specific objectives in mind? How many of you go to the gym or have some other workout routine? Does it ever change? I hope it does. If you do the same things all the time and work out the same way all the time, what happens? Over a period of time, you get fit in one area. You know, you could be the guy who could lift 1,000 pounds, right? But your legs wouldn't support it. Or you couldn't run 20 steps without being winded. There's balance. But in the same way in life, life calls on us to respond to a variety of circumstances. Have you ever been the master of responding well in a crisis at work and just completely exploded at home?
Yeah.
And what do we do with that? Because I know a lot of guys that they'll just stew over that and fret over it and they just... What if we didn't feel guilty? But what if we just said, life has just shown me an area where I am not spiritually fit, and I would like to begin to work out in that area so that I can respond better in that area. So instead of being mad at the difficult circumstances that come into my life, the difficult circumstances have revealed an area where I am now a little bit less fit than I would like to be. However, because I want to be spiritually fit and balanced, I'm going to now begin to work in that area. Does that make sense? That is our goal. Because as we're going to see in a little bit, there's a world watching us to determine whether anything that we say we believe actually makes a difference. Because if the way that I respond to most things in life is no different or no better, no superior in any way to the way everybody else responds, then what good is anything that I say that I believe? Just let that soak in for a little bit. So, back to the original question. When you walk in here on a Saturday morning, I hope you're walking in here exactly the way you would walk into a gym. You know some areas where you're weak. You know some areas where you need to get worked out a little bit. And you have a plan. You're going to sit down and there's certain things that you're hungering for or looking for. And it means, incidentally, that when you interact with other men here, when you interact with me or with the material, that you're going to pose questions that are related to areas where you're hungering for more growth. Does that make sense? That gives you motivation to come here prepared. All right. So here's what we're going to do. Let's turn over to Luke chapter 11 first. And we're going to go to verse 33 in Luke chapter 11. No one, after lighting a lamp, and this is Jesus talking, would put it in a cellar or under a basket, but instead on a stand so that those who enter may see the light. Your eye is the lamp of the body. Now, how many times have you read that phrase? Plenty. Does it strike you as an odd phrase? I mean, when you really look at it, your eye is the lamp of the body. What is that honestly all about? Because that's not really the way you would think of your eye, is it? So let's read on, but let's not forget that odd statement. When your eye is healthy, your whole body is full of light. But when it is bad, your body is full of darkness. Therefore, be careful lest the light in you be darkness. If then your whole body is full of light, having no part dark, it will be wholly bright, as when a lamp with its rays gives you light. Now, you had the advantage of having a text to look at so that you could follow along, hopefully in a translation that was similar, but you had the advantage of being able to look at the words that I just read. Could you imagine being in the audience when Jesus said that? I mean, really, we say that Jesus is a great communicator. He's just delivered this powerful statement. How many of you could sum up what that means right now? Okay, so let's start to break it down. Because here's what he's saying. Your eye is the lamp of the body. What does a lamp do?
brings light.
Provides illumination. And so if you are in the dark and you were to hold a lamp out in front of you, which way would you walk? You would always walk toward the light. Why? It would be foolish to hold the light out here and walk backwards, right? Because what's the probable outcome? You're going to bump into things, you're going to fall over, something's going to happen, right? So you always walk in the direction of the light. If that's true, now go back and look at what Jesus is saying. Your eye is the lamp of the body. In other words, your outlook on life, the way you see people, the way you see everything in life, is going to illuminate your understanding, and you are going to walk in the direction of the way that you see and understand life. And so now look at what Jesus says next. If the light in you is darkness, and that may not be the exact next phrase, but if the light in you is darkness, what's going to happen? See, you're still going to follow what? The light, right? Because the light is out in front of you. But if the light in you is darkness, which way are you going to be walking? You're going to be walking into more darkness. If the light, in other words, if the light in you is bad, if the understandings inside of you are bad, and that is the light that is guiding your way, then what is your path in life going to look like? You're going to be headed in a bad direction. And then he goes on to compound that with one additional statement. That's a statement that should cause every one of us to be really concerned. He says, so if the light in you is darkness, but you actually think that that darkness is light, then you are going to walk confidently. Like, do you walk timidly when you're in this room with all the lights on? Do you walk nervously as if you're going to trip over something? Probably not, because you are confident that you can see. Here's what Jesus is saying. If you are actually confident that you can see, while all the while you're blind, you are going to confidently walk toward your own peril and destruction without a clue as to the direction that you're going. How many of you believe that you can take a journey through life without impacting other people? You're going to take a few people along for the ride. Maybe somebody in this room has gone in a, we'll say, a dark direction and taken a few people along for the ride. So it's not even like it's a solo trip. Turn over to Psalm 119. I have to apologize for using this verse. We've used it before, but it's just really so good. Psalm 119. We're going to go to 105. The whole 119th Psalm is this celebration of God's Word. In as many ways as the writer can say it, with as many clever spins and twists as he can manage, he says again and again the same basic thing. God's Word is a trustworthy source for wisdom, for understanding, to build your life on. Okay, that's his testimony. Now, it's up to us whether we choose to accept that testimony. I want you to understand that. This is one man's statement. This is, in fact, God's statement to us. But each of us gets a choice. I can accept that at face value, or I can disagree with that and go my own way. So here is part of his testimony. Verse 105. Your word is a lamp to my feet and a light to my path. I have sworn an oath and confirmed it to keep your righteous rule. Your word is a lamp to my feet and a light to my path. So what does that say? Okay. It says two things. Yes, you're not wrong, Ron. Yes, you're not wrong. What's the first thing that it says? It's a lamp to my feet.
It's a guide.
I want you to think of two things. There's two words that I want you to remember. And they're critical words, and I hope that if nothing else sticks, that these two words stick. Because remember what we said, you want to be more spiritually fit. God's Word, it says, the writer says, provides two things. It illuminates where I am walking. That's a pebbles issue. What do I mean by that? I can be on the right path. Have you ever been on the right path and tripped? You see, I can be on the right path and there are little obstacles that could trip me up. Are you a committed Christ follower today? Probably. Have you tripped up in the last week? Probably. That's a pebbles issue. Something in the good path that you're walking on caused you to momentarily stumble. Maybe it was more like a boulder instead of a pebble, and maybe you flat out fell on your face this week. I don't know. I find there's pretty many days when I fall on my face spiritually. But what else does it say? It's a light to my path. And we're going to use that word, path. That's a whole different connotation there. So God's word lights up the good path that I'm walking on and helps me to see the areas where I might get tripped up and stumble, so that as I become more spiritually fit, I am less inclined to stumble and fall. But it also does something else. It also puts me on the right path. Because what good would it do if I never tripped, but I was on the wrong path? Just think, if you're struggling here, think highway to hell, okay? It's a good easy phrase to remember, just think highway to hell. Alright, if the highway to hell was well lit, you know, kind of like those big lights at an interchange on an interstate, if it was well lit, you could make excellent time, very few obstacles, you could make a beeline to hell. Now, is that what you want? Do you want to have no stubbed toes on the pathway to hell? That is the distinction here. And the writer is saying that you can count on God's word to do both things. You can count on it when you are committed to walking on the right path to start to show you the little stumbling points in your everyday life. Have you ever had a problem with your wife? Has your wife ever had a problem with you? We'll call that a pebble issue. I know at the time it doesn't feel like a pebble, but we'll call it a pebble issue. But have you ever been on the wrong path? Let's turn back over to Matthew. I guess we'll go to the 6th chapter. Okay, so we're going to really quickly read, starting at verse 22, Matthew 6, 22. Same basic text again. There's a principle I want you to see that you'll find in the Gospels again and again. And you have to know the Gospel, the four Gospel books, pretty well before you start to see it. Jesus uses similar teaching again and again. He uses common phrases and ideas again and again. Sometimes he uses the principle and connects the principle to a particular practice. Do you understand the difference? Jesus takes a principle and connects it to a practice. What we're going to read here in a minute is a principle connected to a practice. But at other times, he uses just the principle and he links it to something different, or he introduces a principle but doesn't connect it to a practice. In this case, we're going to see the light thing, but we're going to see it connected to a practice. The eye is the lamp of the body, so if your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light. Now remember this thing right here. Remember, connect these two things. What we talked about your eye, is it possible for your eye to miss the pebbles? Yeah, we do that all the time. Which means what? There is some part of my spiritual vision that is not completely clear. Why do we behave in ways that we know are going to take us to bad results? Come on. Why do you say the wrong thing to your wife? Come on, why? You know why. Because it feels right at the time, doesn't it? Am I the only one in the room who does this? Come on. But I also...
It's learning not to do that.
Listen, my job is to share information. That doesn't mean I necessarily receive it well all the time myself. I'm a work in progress just the same as all of you. And don't anybody say amen to that right now, please. But Most of us, I think, are beyond the point where we're rushing steadfastly, completely in the wrong direction. So for most of us, there's pebble issues. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light in you is darkness, and here's that phrase, how great is that darkness? Remember, this is describing us when we think we can see, but we're deluding ourselves, and we don't see at all. And then he gets to this, he now ties principle to a practice. No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. Now that's a path issue. We're no longer at a pebbles issue, that's a path issue. You have to decide in life, he says, what is going to be your master. We all have a Lord in life. It's pretty tough to escape having a Lord in life. Even when you are the Lord of your life, you usually desire things that end up lording over you. And how many of you have wanted things that required significant finance? How many of you have ended up enslaved and having something lording over you because of the wants that you had? See, when I put myself as Lord of my life, I usually end up making decisions that are bad and end up placing me in a position where I'm no longer the Lord of my life. I'm somebody else's slave. And so what Jesus is promising here, he doesn't say it right here, is you just make up your mind. Who's going to be your Lord? Because in the end, the person that you decide will be your Lord is either going to be someone who will bring you freedom and life. Isn't that what we want? Life's goal, learning how to live in freedom. Or it's going to be someone who's going to enslave you or disappoint you. When you were the Lord of your life, did you ever disappoint you? Were you ever not able to come through when you promised yourself you would come through? But how long does it take to really believe that God is trustworthy? How long do we dabble? And this is the difficulty, right? It would be one thing if the pathways were so divergent and so clear that they could be easily seen. It was either a genuine left or right issue. So that the further you went in one direction, the further away from the other direction you were going. Do you know in this country at this time, it is very possible to kind of like straddle paths and pretend that you're walking God's way while you're actually walking your own? And that's where it becomes really challenging. That's where the light in you that you think is light but may actually be darkness can be keeping you on the wrong path all the while making you think you're on the right path. Turn back a little bit in Matthew. The end of the fourth chapter. Before we move into this, any discussion now? Anything you heard that you're curious about, that you'd like to interact with the material or with each other about?
Pastor John's sermon on Sunday talked about David and Goliath facing the giants that are in their lives. The giant, this discussion, choosing God or choosing money, for me, we were talking about it, we had things pointed out this week that have shown that we're not spiritually fit. But we have an area of growth to spiritual fitness. And for me, it was discerning the comfort for my family. That is a giant in my life right now. The disciples in Acts 2 sold all their possessions and gave to those who had need. I'm not a disciple. I just aren't. But I have in the past. I got lots of stuff. I got the material stuff. The giant is comfort and a sense of, am I willing to look? Am I willing to be less wealthy so that somebody who's poor can be better off than me?
And when is it appropriate too? And this is where we all struggle. When is it appropriate? When is it appropriate to help someone financially at my expense? And when have I done them more harm than good by helping them financially at my expense? And we have all these things that we have to balance out. As a matter of fact, not that there's ever a time when there isn't a lot of discussion about government involvement, but some of the circumstances in the past week and what we'll say are practices that some people are questioning about police forces and all that are raising issues about why is there so much unrest in the black community? And how are black people better off today than they were 50 years ago in the inner city? And what's contributing to that? And how has our government done good or how has government failed? And how has government helped? And how has government not helped? These big social issues that we're wrestling with. And we don't seem to be able to find answers to. But infinitely practical. And so when he says, well, I'm not sure, and I kind of want to cling to my comfort. How many of us understand what he's saying? I kind of want to cling to my comfort. Deep down inside, I know that I could probably do without this thing or that thing. I could probably forego that movie or this extra subscription or that extra thing. And I could probably help somebody out. And then there's the, but I worked hard all week and I kind of deserve it feeling. And I'm not putting words in his mouth because maybe he doesn't feel that way. Maybe he knows he didn't work hard all week. I don't know. But he still thinks he deserves it. Maybe that's his issue. Anybody else? But see, isn't it good that we raise the question and let everybody know that we're all struggling with it? Because I don't know about you, but if I know that we're all in this together, I am more prone to sacrifice when I know that I'm part of a band of brothers who is equally committed to sacrifice. Now, I suppose that's just something small and petty and weak inside of me, honestly, because I should be willing to sacrifice even if nobody else sacrifices. But it's somehow more comforting to know that I am in the presence of others who are committed to a certain cause. Like, I would kind of start to feel foolish if I were the one guy in the neighborhood sacrificing while everybody else had four cars in the driveway. You know, I would kind of feel foolish about that while I was driving junk and living in the shack that was surrounded by $800,000 houses. All the while I was sacrificing. I'd feel dumb. But if I lived next to a number of other people who all lived in shacks and drove junk, then I would feel better about my sacrifice. And I think that says more about me than it does about the value of, doesn't it?
But God isn't asking us to do that.
No.
Just want to make that clear. Mammon is a spirit on money. He's not saying just money. Mammon is the spirit of greed, selfishness, mm-hmm. worship of. Because God uses the mundane thing of money, which we're talking about. So that's not the evil, but how are we going to handle this now? But it doesn't mean I'm more holy if I have to give out poverty.
Oh, no. No.
Body and word poverty. We're going to have to ask people to help us then. So, and God doesn't, he says...
All right, so we've turned back to Matthew, the 4th chapter. We're going to start at the 17th verse. From that time, Jesus began to preach, saying, "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand." And that time was after John is imprisoned. And so John is no longer delivering this message. The way is opened up for Jesus now to take the lead in championing this message. And then it says, "While walking by the Sea of Galilee, he saw two brothers, Simon, who he called Peter, and Andrew, his brother, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. And he said to them, 'Follow me, and I will make you fishers of men.'" Now Jesus had met these guys before, had interacted with them. He's now back in Galilee, and basically what he's doing is finding these guys that he has met before, and they've expressed some interest in him, and he's saying to them now, "Okay, would you like to make this a full-time choice? You followed me for a little while, you followed me for a few weeks, you saw what I was about and what I was doing, and now I'm coming back to see if you would like to make this your life's work." And immediately they left their nets and followed him. And so presumably in the months between when they had followed Jesus for a short term before and now, they had both had a lot of conversations that said, "You know, I think if he came back, I think if he showed up again, I'd be willing to leave all this." Now maybe it was a particularly bad night of fishing, I don't know. Maybe they just had it with nets Maybe they just had an argument with their dad. We don't know all the circumstances, but I have a feeling that there were many conversations that took place, and they said, if he comes back, I think I'd like to go this way. And going on from there, he saw two more brothers, James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, in the boat with Zebedee, their father, mending their nets, and he called them. And immediately they left their boat and their father and followed him. And he went through all of Galilee, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every disease and every affliction among the people. So his fame spread throughout all Syria. Now right there's a pivotal phrase. So his fame spread. Why did his fame spread? See, he's involved in two things. What are the two things that he's involved in? Well, he's involved in teaching and he's involved in healing. It says he's teaching in their synagogues and he's going about healing. Which does Jesus get a reputation for? You can tell by what happens afterwards. And they brought him all the sick and those afflicted with various diseases and pains and those oppressed by demons. You notice they didn't bring all the people who wanted more information. They didn't bring the people who wanted a different way to live. They didn't bring people who needed a different outlook on life. They brought more broken people whose lives were in a mess physically. So that's why Jesus was famous. We can see that. And great crowds followed him from Galilee and the Decapolis and from Jerusalem and Judea and from beyond the Jordan. And so seeing the crowds, he went up on a mountain. Another interesting phrase. Why does he go up on a mountain? I mean, is he like scared of crowds? What's up with that? Seeing the crowds, he moves, it would seem, away from the crowd. That's a possibility, but let me suggest something different. And when he sat down, his disciples came to him. There's a little bit of a weeding out that's taking place here. Are you in my presence? Are you following after me because of what I can do for you here and now? Or would you like to learn a new way to live? Would you like to climb up the mountain and sit with me? Or would you just like to stay down on the plane and wait until I come back down there and do more good stuff for you? Would you like to make you the center of your life and I will make your problems go away? Or would you like me to be the center of your direction and your pathway, in which case you're going to have to follow me up the mountain and you're going to sit with me and we're going to discuss life? Which is it that you would prefer? And so there's a natural weeding out process that takes place, and I believe there were a lot of people who don't make the trip up the mountain. And we can kind of see that that's the focus, because for the next, what we'll call the next several chapters, which must have taken hours and hours to deliver, delivered thoughtfully, delivered undoubtedly with interaction with the crowd and questions, maybe breaks. And he talks about a whole new way to live. And so this is really great spiritual fitness material here. I'm going to go through it very quickly because we don't have time to cover it all. I mean, I've spent time in this before with you guys. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Incidentally, when you see this "for theirs is," and it's like a you do this, you get that, don't assume that it is a direct cause and effect kind of a thing, because he uses the same phrases a couple of times. What does it mean to be poor in spirit? And especially in light of everything that we're talking about this morning.
Well, like you said, you're not spiritually fit. You're lacking in your spirit.
But they know it. There's a lot of people there that don't make the trip up the mountain. Are they all spiritually fit? No, they just don't care. Or at least at this moment, they don't care. And so he says, blessed are the poor in spirit, those who are aware of that. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Again, what does that mean? There's an awareness there. There's something missing in my life. There's something that I would like to be right that I sense isn't right. Blessed are the meek. In other words, those who have a controlled strength. And we go right down this list. And then he tells them what their purpose is to be. Now, what do you suppose that the people who have come to Jesus to have needs met, what do you think their purpose is? What is the purpose of your next door neighbor? What is his purpose for life? Honestly, you ever thought about that? Why do most people go through, why do most people go to work? To live another day? That's a pretty short-term goal, isn't it? To live another day. Okay, to live month to month, paycheck to paycheck, whatever it is. What else? Huh? Oh, to be able to live when you're not working. Okay, so to be able to pay my bills now, maybe to save enough money so that when I'm no longer working, I'll have money to still pay my bills. I'm not saying that's a bad objective. That sounds like it might be a useful thing to do. What else? What else are most people living for? Okay, let me ask this a different way. All right, let's get personal. What do you use to live for?
Me.
Yeah. What are you living for? Selfish desires. Just living for self. Very short term, very short sighted.
Another pleasure, another experience, another moment of happiness.
But, you know, this is basic, but, you know, we were faced with, you know, life this week, two funerals, and you think of the lives they touched, the lives they impacted. You know, Teresa's mom's in the nursing home. There was a lady there that had been a roommate. She wasn't that old, but because of physical problems, she was there. She was bitter, angry, a nasty lady. Wasn't nice. You know, and you could get to talk to her and, you know, a little bit more. She died. She had alienated. There was no husband in her life. Her kids were distant. You think, what lives did she touch and affect? What was she really living for? What was all that? She just died alone. Miserable, lonely, angry, bitter at everybody. It was quite evident. It's a sad epitaph on her life.
Yeah. So, look at where he goes from here. And you have to understand this whole Sermon on the Mount based on this simple premise of, are you going to, what path are you going to take? That's what these next two chapters are about. First off, what path are you going to take? And then if you choose one path, what are the pebbles that you're likely to encounter in that path? And so he gives them a purpose. You are salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. Okay, we've used that term again and again. But this is why you're here, he's saying. This is a large part of why I've called you. If you would like to be my disciples, understand this. This is one of your key purposes. You now, instead of being one of the people at the bottom of the mountain that lives for themselves and looks to, and maybe now's a good time to draw this. So we have my starting point here. So over here are my goals. And incidentally, goals aren't wrong. And God becomes the pathway, and God becomes the device that I use to get to my goals. God bless my this. God help me do that. God make me feel better. Come on, we've all been there, right? God becomes the pathway that gets me to my point of happiness. Versus over here is God's, we'll call them objectives. And remember, since, and this is a big thing that you have to understand, this sounds horribly domineering of God unless you understand that God is a God of love and wants our best interest. Do you understand? See, when you think God's objectives, that turns us into nothing but chattel and slaves. Unless we understand that God is a God of love who wants the best for those who serve Him. And now God's Word becomes the pathway that we can walk to more accurately achieve God's objectives. So either God becomes the path that I use to get to my stuff, and God's not going to long let you use Him as the pathway. Or God's Word becomes the pathway that I walk to get to God's objectives. Now, we got to get through this very quickly, but we're just going to sort of like thumb through the next few chapters here. Here's one of the first issues he addresses. Anger. He says, I know you've all heard that it's bad to kill people. That's probably not good. But what's the issue going on in your heart, and what do you think of people? Because if you're going to be my follower, if you're going to be salt and light in this world, if your purpose is going to be my follower, you're going to have to process anger differently than people who aren't my followers. You're going to have to learn to manage human relationships differently than those who haven't chosen to follow me. And let's be real, isn't this one great challenge? What do you do with people when you're angry with them? How do you process the moments in your life when you are deeply distressed and disappointed by some of your closest human relationships? That was not a rhetorical question. You're free to answer. Okay, how about you yell and shout at them? How about you pout and you don't talk to them? How about you're vindictive and spiteful and find clever ways to get back at them? If I hit on your favorite one, or is there one that I've left out? Come on, we all have favorite ways. And we usually have multiple ways because not everybody responds the same to the same things. He says, if you're going to be my followers, you're going to need my guidance to be able to respond in all human relationships in a different way, and it's not going to be natural for you. Can we get an amen to that? It's not going to be natural for you to respond well in difficult human relationship circumstances. It's going to be a way that you will look different from those that are down at the bottom of the mountain. And then he moves on to the subject of lust. Okay, well, this is a great male topic. Not that it's exclusively a male topic, but isn't it a great male topic? How are you going to manage, let's just call it, all of your physical appetites? Do we know people that are at the bottom of the mountain, and I'm not using this in a derogatory term, they've just not made a commitment to follow Christ, they're on a different path. Do we all know people who are controlled by their appetites? Do we all know people whose appetites have taken them to very destructive and harmful places, both to themselves and to those around them, of course? And so he says, if you're going to be my follower, you're going to have to deal with the tough stuff of how do you control your appetites. Do you see how much this is a spiritual fitness issue? So the way you respond to relationships when they are difficult is a spiritual fitness issue. The way you respond to your physical appetites is a spiritual fitness issue. Giving to the needy. The way you respond to the needs of those around you is a spiritual fitness issue. But then he goes on and he touches on some other stuff, because not all of us have the same issues. See, some people have been on the path out somewhere else. We'll call it the world, because that sounds like a great spiritual term. We'll call them the wicked, horrible heathens out there in the world, right? Meanwhile, there has been another whole group of people. We'll call them the self-righteous, horribly annoying religious people. And Jesus has to have a talk with them too. And he says, yeah, and about this fasting thing, and about this praying to look good for others, and about all that stuff. You're really going to have to think about that. Do you genuinely have a desire to relate to me as your guide through life? Or is your primary purpose in your religious practices to make a great impression on your neighbors? You see, today that would feel weird, right? I mean, you wouldn't want to be overly religious because your neighbors would just flat out think you were weird. But at that time and place, to be uber religious would have been a badge of honor. So it's kind of different. And then he goes on to the next thing. And about worry, he says. And if Jesus were maybe to stand up and he'd say, okay, let's have a show of hands. How many of you have done some really serious, hardcore worrying in the last week? And how many hands would have gone up? And maybe there would have been a little audience dialogue. And what did you worry about? Well, you know, I can't pay my bills. Guy's going to come kick me out of my flat, and I don't know what to do. And you? Well, my kids, they're going bad, and I don't know what to do about that. See, about this worry thing, can you trust me with your problems? Or am I going to be this thing that gets you to your goals? And why are you even worrying about it? Why do you want your kids to be good kids anyway? Do you want your kids to be good kids because you want best for them? Or because if you don't have good kids, it's like a black mark on you? Come on, don't say you don't understand that, right? Who hasn't been embarrassed about their kids at least once in life? But he's not done. And this is where we need to bore down into this personally. And he says, and about this business that you have of judging others. So don't you have enough stuff in your own life to deal with? Aren't there enough issues that you have to confront? Do you really need to be looking at that guy over there and comparing yourself to him? And why do we compare ourselves to other people, incidentally?
Trying to make ourselves feel better, look better.
Of course we do, because it's really easier to look at you and say, huh, I thought I was messed up, and I started to feel bad about myself and my relationships and all that, and then I looked at you, and I thought, you know what? I'm okay.
Thank God for you.
Let's turn over to 7:7. Beautiful words. We've read them a number of times already, but let's read them again. Ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and it will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives, and the one who seeks finds. And then the one who knocks, it will be opened. Oh, that was Matthew 7:7. Didn't I say that?
You said 7:7.
Well, we were in Matthew already, so it... So, what's the final thing that he is assuring these guys that are on the mountain? Guys, ladies, whatever. What's the final thing? He's saying, I know this is difficult. I know this is a real departure from the way you are accustomed to living. As a matter of fact, according to the way that you have been taught, the light in your eye has told you for years, this is the pathway that you should walk on. I'm actually calling you to walk on a different path. And so I know that there's some darkness in you, yet there's some lack of understanding. And you're going to be confused. Because you're going to go back home after this inspiring message, and you're going to confront your wife and your kids whom you're still having friction with, and this is all going to be put to the test. And I know it's not always going to go well for you. And you're going to be confused. So I want you to know this, that the whole time you are making this journey, leaving this path and going this path, the whole time that you're trying to make this journey, I want you to know that my wisdom is available to you for how to deal with everyday life. Don't be afraid to ask. Which one of you, his son asks him for bread, will give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, will give him a serpent? If you then, who are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father, who is in heaven, give good things to those who ask him? So sometimes you can imagine in the minds of those people, and it's a little different for us because we've been conditioned to believe in a God of grace and mercy. They were not so much conditioned to believe in a God of grace and mercy. But incidentally, we still struggle with that. And so sometimes we're afraid to go to God after we have failed, which is usually when we go to God. I didn't handle that well. That blew up. I lost my temper. I said things that I regretted. And then what do we do with that? Well, it would be awkward to go to God then, because then I'd have to start by saying, wow, I really made a mess of that, didn't I? Before I could even ask for wisdom. He says, Don't be intimidated about going to God. God is not the kind of a God who is going to give you more junk to deal with. When you go to Him for help, He's not going to give you an additional burden of guilt. He's not going to give you a bad gift when you go to Him. Look, He says, if you fathers, when your kids have a need, and you go to dad, I mean, you guys know what to give. You don't give something toxic and poisonous and bad for the kid when they come for something good. Why would you think that the God of love is going to give you a bad gift when you have failed and you go to Him and you want help and you say, I don't know what to do? He's not going to make you feel worse about the circumstance. And that's how I would like you to live day by day. Questions? Comments? Let's interact.
I was watching a movie the other night, and this guy was a drug dealer, bad gang member, and he meets this girl. She's trying to get him to go to church, and he keeps making excuses. He's busy, busy, busy. And she finally gets to him and said, you know, tell me why you won't go to church. And he, you know, burst out that God doesn't want people like me in His church. So, you know, I guess there's this more than a pebble, I guess, a boulder with people that feel unworthy that they can't come to God with whatever it is that they're going through. And they deal with that challenge that they're not, you know, they're not good enough to be in God's presence.
Can we go back to the beginning of chapter 7? Because he touched on an interesting point. Judge not that you not be judged. For with the judgment you pronounce, you will be judged. And with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Why do you see the speck that is in your brother's eye, but not notice the log that is in your own eye? Now, in light of what Jesus just said about what is our eye? The lamp of our body. So what do you suppose would happen if I took a 2x4 and jammed it into that light? I'll bet it would, huh? How much light would that shed? It would really make cool effects for a moment. We should do that sometime just to see what would happen. You'd have to be absent that week. Do you see what he's saying? He's saying the time when you are most prone to judge your brother, you have the poorest vision. The lamp of your own eye is not seeing clearly, because if the lamp of your own eye were seeing clearly, you would see your own struggles, and then you would see your brother through the context of your struggles, and you would remember how hard it is to live this well. And you would begin to have compassion for your brother and not judgment for your brother. And you may be wondering why I introduced that. Where do people get the idea that they're not good enough to come to God? Do they get that from God? Or do they get that from us?
Clearly, that's not God. You know, you see that, the whole mission, that's who God comes for. That's who Jesus came for. Yes. Right.
So, this right here, us walking around with 2x4s in our eye, passing judgment on other people, is a big part of the reason why people stay away from God. Any other comments before I move on? It's good.
There was a lady this week who said to me, how come I can see the speck so easy, but I can't see the board in my own eyes? And while we were sitting there praying with her, it dawned on me, how easy is it to look up and see a board in your eye? It's very easy to stay focused on right here, but to look up for help is extremely hard.
All right, we're going to move into chapter number 8. When he came down from the mountain, great crowds followed him. Again, we're back to the crowds. And behold, a leper came to him and knelt before him, saying, Lord, if you will, you can make me clean. And Jesus stretched out his hand and touched him, saying, I will, be clean. And immediately the leprosy was cleansed. So he comes down from the mountain, and what is the very next thing that approaches him? More need. But look at how he redirects it. He says, I would love to heal you. He's not at all bitter about it. He's not cynical. He's not saying, oh, you ungrateful bunch of unwashed masses, what's wrong with y'all? Instead, he says, I will and be clean. But then what does he do? See that you say nothing to anyone, but go show yourself to the priest and offer the gift that Moses commanded for a proof to them. Now, why is that important? Because this leper was an outcast. He could not fellowship with God at the temple. He could not fellowship with other people because to other people he was an outcast. But with the approval of the priest, he was now fit to go to the temple again, offer sacrifices, to fellowship with other people, to commune with God, and to consider himself an equal son of God to every other man in Jewish community. And so what Jesus is saying is, I'm going to heal you physically. But don't you dare stop with that physical healing. You take that physical healing and you go show the priest. And you go get reintroduced to community and you get restored to fellowship with other people. And you get back in there and be part of community. I didn't heal you so that you can stay fit on the side. I healed you so that you can get back into community. And we're going to leave with this one final thing, which is, I mean, I found this fascinating when I read this week. And when he entered Capernaum, a centurion came forward to him, appealing to him, Lord, my servant is lying paralyzed at home, suffering terribly. And he said to him, I will come and heal him. But the centurion replied, Lord, I'm not worthy to have you come under my roof, but only say the word and my servant will be healed. Now this whole thing is a very familiar story. We're headed toward a particular phrase that I want us to focus on. For I too am a man under authority with soldiers under me, and I say to one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my servant, do this, and he does it. When Jesus heard this, he marveled and said to those who followed him, truly I tell you, with no one in Israel have I found such faith. Now, consider how many people he's just interacted with. Right? Crowds. And then committed crowds, right, who followed him up the mountain. It was more than 5 or 6 people that were up there on the mountain with him. There were a number of people who were really committed to Jesus at this time. This, incidentally, is his first year. This is the year that typically people refer to as his year of popularity. Jesus didn't have a lot of enemies yet. He was working on it, but he hadn't acquired many because he's doing all this stuff and people love it. Then he says, I tell you, many will come from the east and the west and recline at table, and this is it, with Abram, with Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. And I'll guarantee you that nobody batted an eye when they heard that. That sounds like something you've heard again and again, isn't it? What do you think he is saying? Many will come and have fellowship, ongoing fellowship with God, along with, and it's these icons, these pillars of the Hebrew faith. And they will recline at table with Abram and Isaac and Jacob. You know why I found that to be a remarkable statement? Have you ever really considered, have you ever really bored into these guys' lives? So let's start with Abraham. Right? If you're going to set Abraham up as the guy who is worthy to be in God's presence, right? Here's a guy who basically lies about his wife so that he can save his own neck. It's the guy who, when his wife says, okay, look, we're not having any kids. Do you want to sleep with my servant girl? And Abraham says, well, sure, I guess I'll do that.
Is this a trick question? Do I look fat in this?
And it's the guy who, after he's mission accomplished with the slave girl, after they have a kid, and then the wife is bitter and envious of that, what does Abram do? Does he act like the man of the house and step in? He says, well, then you deal with the problem. That's the Abram that Jesus is talking about. See, for all these people who are thinking about righteous Israelites, if they actually considered the stories of the men whom they think as the pillars of faith, the icons of Hebrew solidity, they're not all that. They're just mere mortals, mere men that are learning a day at a time how to trust God and walk with God. And this is what Jesus is saying. I'm telling you, there are people from all over this globe, not just you guys right here. There are people from all over this globe who are learning to follow God a day at a time, and they're doing it in fits and starts. They're stumbling one day and they're picking themselves up the next, and they're learning how this is done. And there's no room for self-righteousness in this kingdom. And he goes on to emphasize that. Well, the sons of the kingdom. Well, are they really the sons of the kingdom? See, if they're the sons of the kingdom, they'll be there. He says, but the sons of the kingdom will be thrown into outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And let's just, in uppercase letters, put the word regret there. There are going to be massive regrets because now their eyes are actually going to be opened. And so what he's saying is, we can all fellowship with each other so long as we are willing to understand that all of us are learning how to follow God a day at a time, imperfectly as it may be, failing a lot, but we're still pursuing. We got this right, and we're just struggling with this. And once you get this right, don't be surprised when there's a lot of that in the way, but we can help each other through that.